This will start now. Thank you very much for coming. Let me introduce our speaker today, Christoph Engel. So he studied physics at the University of Karlsruhe and at ETH Zurich, and then obtained his PhD from Karlsruhe in 2010, working at the Institute of Theoretical Physics. Then held postdoctoral positions at Institute of Theoretical Physics at University of Heidelberg and at the Institute of Particle Physics Phenomenology at Durham University. In July 2013, he joined the Theoretical Particle Physics group at the University of Glasgow, where he has been a professor of theoretical physics and later in the particle theory group. In October 2025, he joined the High-Energy Physics Group at the University of Manchester, and has also worked with people from Wide-Eyed Edition on a children's book that was on Destination Space, which was published in September 2016.
Wow, got all the information there.
Yes, and today he will present his view on what lies ahead beyond the standard model.
Well, that sets me up for failure. Thank you. Well, it's great to be back here. I think when I look through my CV, as you have to do when you apply somewhere else, as I did from Glasgow joining Manchester, I saw that actually one of the first seminars I gave in the UK after arriving in 2011 was really at RAL. So the heydays of this discovery, and as you can see on the one-trick pony, I still do pretty much the same stuff. So I want to talk about beyond the standard model of physics, and specifically how that would link to the weak scale and deep scale observations. And why is that? Because I think it's fair to say that, at least numerically speaking, we have no idea why the TUV scale shows up in nature exactly the way it does. What we now understand post-2012 experimental discovery is that there is qualitatively little other choice for that to happen in exactly the way it does. Whereas the mass parameters, that's for discussion, for the investigation. But this is my kind of desperate attempt to condense all of our contemporary understanding of particle physics into one simple diagram. Kind of links all these different concepts that we learn about maybe as undergrad students, but they really feed into each other and determine the physics that we see at very, very high energy. And that's not specific to the TUV scale. So if you like your work being done in neutrino physics, you're very much in these constraints as well. So on the one hand side, we deploy this methodology of quantum field theory. It's a very old kind of old in the physics understanding. It isn't, so it was developed in the 50s by Eisenberg and others, Jordan. But through the years, we understood that there are certain things that we can't make. So we have to distinguish internal symmetries from external symmetries, and symmetries really are the name of the game here. So external symmetries really means that we can label particles with their spin. And internal symmetries, flavor symmetries that we can link ups and downs and strangers in the early days of pre-QCD, but also gauge symmetries like electrodynamics and QCD, for instance. So on the one hand side, we have then massless vectors, so we can introduce vector particles as we do. Maxwell's equations famous, we do that. But to keep the massless and in a theoretically controlled way, we have to involve these gauge symmetries, and that's really not the way of things. At the same time, for fermions, but they're massive or light, we can map these hierarchies onto approximate symmetries as we observe them. So if fermions are light at some high scale, they will remain light all the way to those scales. And this is one of the reasons why flavor model building, especially in the lepton sector, is very, very tricky. Once you want to make concrete TUV scale predictions that are within reach of the experimental observations that we can provide. Well, And last but not least, so this was really the status until 2012, maybe the 60s, if you believe in the theoretical literature. François Anglais and Proud, and others, I should say. But really, the way of introducing massive vector bosons that were also observed in Gargamel and then they want to UA1 and UA2, the only way to do this consistently in a quantum field theory picture is by means of this infamous Higgs mechanism, which then introduces additional scalars that we have discovered, or at least one particularly simple version of that we have discovered. So far, so good. There are many ways of how we can implement a picture like that. And typically, if we put take a random theory off the shelf, it will not reproduce the standard model as we observe it in nature. So the standard model within that context, which is very, very broad, is extremely restrictive and is so really almost by accident. So a few things that seem to be very, very puzzling is that Baryon number conservation is really built into this framework within the context of the standard model as an accidental symmetry. CP violation is very, very small. And then, of course, it's troublesome if we like more Baryons than anti-Baryons in the universe, and I think we all do. There are more theoretically founded questions. For instance, why is the WZ mass ratio exactly the way it does, and why does it link to the ratio of charge versus neutral current interactions exactly the way we do it, the way we see it as an additional symmetry, which is exactly mental in the model. But there's also a lot more trouble in theory land, which probably fair to say that has been and bugging all of us for the past 40 years or so, but no good progress has been made there. So there's a strong CP problem, there's six naturalness, which just tells you when you write down the defining principle of the standard model, really write it down in terms of the Lagrangian, you would naively expect different terms to be there or other terms to be very, very sizable, but somehow they turn out to be very, very small. And even what's even more puzzling is that this small number is actually a cancellation between two nicely large numbers. And unless you have symmetry that tells you that there's an exact cancellation, it's not natural to expect these terms to be absent. So, for instance, the small neutron electric dipole moment, and of course, the lightness of the Higgs mass compared to whatever cutoffs that we might see in nature. And on top of all of this, we know, or we don't really have a different contender in our toolbox as such, that we know that the universe has undergone a really kind of classical evolution relatively early on in the universe that is linked to modified gravity. Of course, gravity does not feature in this picture whatsoever. So a lot more open questions than answers. But what particle physics really does, it tries to patch things together by looking at what the experiments are, what you're giving us. And somehow the standard model is kind of almost too good to be true. So it's unexpectedly accurate. And I took by no other reason than luck because I saw this picture by others first. This is a whole collection of cross-section times branching ratio observations normalized to the standard model expectation. And you can see that this kind of gives you a nice chi squared. So if I was never good in lab work, and usually I had to kind of fudge the chi squared to make it through by the skin of my teeth. And I would have been very pleased with such an outcome. Okay, so it looks very good for the sample. But that being said, it only gives very, very limited insights into what the Higgs boson interactions are. So the nature of the TV scale is very closely linked to the properties of it. So if they're more than a thin Higgs boson, all of these things kind of get modified, of course. But what these kind of all this plethora of numbers, they link essentially to these two classes of interactions. So the interactions of a single Higgs boson with massive gauge bosons, and the interactions of the Higgs boson with massive fermions. And of course, if you pop these in the loop, and then you get interactions with massless gauge bosons, for instance, gluon fusion, which is the dominant production cross-section for the Higgs boson at the LHC. So there's a partial insight into how these things behave at quantum level as well. So taking that at heart, looking at all the theoretical shortcomings that we live with, what are the possibilities? And I put a disclaimer here. And what I want to talk today about is mainly TUV scale phenomenology, which is, of course, not representative of all the work that you are doing here. Of course, there's a lot more development in neutrino physics as well, but also in the landscape of cosmology. That's a fair time of going up and saying a few words about that. So if you interrupt me at any point in time, if there are questions, you know, don't hold back. I am here to please. So without further ado, what can these six couplings that we've measured, what can they tell us, and how can we make progress in a little bit? So we've seen that perturbativity has been a huge success story. So the whole picture that I showed you, linking gauge and X sectors with spontaneous broken symmetries, etc., that's a huge success story. And it's been a success story for 40, 50 years. So essentially, by assuming the standard models only by looking at set four data from lab one, could gather really a relatively tight window where the Higgs boson should sit. I think it was in that fit, it was around 130, 140 GeV. A lot of you might not remember that Ruben plot, but that the Higgs boson was found at 125 GeV. Could almost guess this from radiative imprints in set boson position physics and W position physics. So just looking at this historic example and fast forwarding to 2026, there is no reason not to trust in this framework once more. And instead of asking the question of what triggers electronic symmetry breaking and how do we model it, maybe we can pick up a different problem off the shelf that is not a good standard model itself and try to make progress with that, also with a view towards what might come beyond the high-luminosity LHC phase. And of course, then there are many options. So writing down new physics models is a sport that a lot of people indulge in. But perhaps we can kind of focus this around some well-defined questions and well-defined requirements in nature, and then try to draw relatively broad conclusions as to what might be useful to look for at present and future colliders, or where these things might be hiding. Right. So, and one thing that I want to focus here today on is baryogenesis. So we know that there are more baryons in the universe than antibaryons. We know that this can't be necessarily an accidental generation during the early period of the development of the universe. This would be, again, yet another fine-tuning problem. We have plenty of those. There's no merit, I think, in accepting small cancellations and go from there. But if you want to explain this in a dynamical way, Sakharov wrote down, Andrei Sakharov wrote down three relatively broadly defined criteria that we need to tick off in order to get more baryons and antibaryons as part of the evolution of the universe. And those three are, if we want more baryons than antibaryons, it's quite natural that we want baryon number violation. So I said earlier that baryon number conservation is actually an accidental symmetry in standard models, so something else needs to happen. Yeah. But that's a perturbative statement. There are actually non-perturbative configurations that trigger baryon number violation. Those are the so-called phalerons. Very quantitatively on the next slide, explain how those come about. So in principle, the standard model can deliver that. So it's a tick mark with some disclaimer attached. There's C violation, of course, we see that. In the weakened version, there's CP violation. In standard model, there's only one single source of CP violation. If you neglect the neutrino sector, I should say that, which is phase of the CKM matrix. And of course, we did a similar phase in the PMNS matrix as well. But these are too small to account for the practicing around the numerics. We see that actually the standard model does not really produce enough CP violation for the Sakharov criteria to be numerically satisfied. Qualitatively, yes, but not sufficiently. And on top of all of these things, it's something that's slightly more opaque. It's need a departure from from equilibrium, which means that you cannot reverse the process essentially of creative violence. So if you don't, well, in a way, it's like opening a fizzy water bottle. You can't get the gas back in. You can just have a phase transition that happens there. So if you can reverse that, then the universe will turn any baryon asymmetry back into a symmetry. So, I mean, we'll see in a second, hopefully, what this means in more concrete terms. If we want to marry baryogenesis together with the electromagnetic scale, then that's another possibility to make a little bit of progress. And the way this works here is by kind of tapping into this infamous sphaleron process that converts chirality, so an overabundance of left chiral fields compared to right chiral fields, or right chiral fields compared to left chiral fields, into baryon numbers, essentially a field configuration that changes baryon number and electron number in very specific ways. So you can think of it a little bit like alpha decay, where you have to tunnel from your central potential to the outside. That's possible quantum mechanically, but those two different vacuum configurations correspond to different numbers in baryon electron number. That's one way of thinking about it. And if the temperature is high enough, then, or enough energy is available, then the sphaleron will just be very, very active, and that decay into different vacua, different baryon electron numbers will be unsuppressed. So this is one of the ways of looking at it. And this happens with sort of crucial ratios, as we always like to express things in theoretical physics. So it's the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field at a given temperature and the constant evolution. It's the sphaleron energy. So that will be how quickly that process decays away. So if the temperature is high enough and that V is relatively small, then essentially this guy will be completely unsuppressed. So it works. So how electric baryogenesis then works in practice is the departure from equilibrium you introduce via first order phase transition. The first order phase transition creates bubbles, and those bubbles will expand in the universe. And what creates a departure from equilibrium is the bubble wall. So that really tells you that something in front of the bubble will behave very, very different compared to the inside of the bubble. And there's something that you can't reverse. If the bubble expands, you can never reverse that process. You can't unbubble the universe. And then a lot of magic happens on the bubble wall. So in addition to CP violation, you add CP violation to this picture, is what I mean. So in front of the wall, you have a symmetric phase between left and right chirostates, or left-handed fermions couple exactly like right-handed fermions in the purpose of this picture. Yeah, at high enough temperature, that's the case, the symmetric phase. But if you have CP violation in the interactions with the bubble wall, it will create an overabundance of one chirality to the other. And what the sphaleron then will do is will unsuppress, turn this chiral excess into baryon number. And the baryon number will accumulate in front of that wall. And as the wall sort of sweeps over the baryon number, it will pull that baryon number into the broken phase, where now that sphaleron process is heavily suppressed. So if V, that's that expectation value, if that's zero, then essentially you freeze in the baryon number on that side. So essentially it's a kind of a three-step process. You generate a chiral overabundance, you transfer that in a sphaleron, by the sphaleron to baryon number, then you freeze the baryon number in the spontaneously broken phase. So that's relatively well understood how to do that. So now, how do we kind of contextualize that with the weak scale? So electrobaryogenesis does so we need a strong first order phase transition to trigger all this bubble nucleation. And one way of doing this without changing too much of the stuff that we've seen and like so far in LHC data is by modifying the Higgs sector itself, because we have a relatively limited insight into how the Higgs sector works, you know, how the gauge bosons and the fermions interact with it, but not so much how the Higgs interacts with itself or an extended spectrum and the scalar sector. What that gives you phenomenologically is perhaps a set of additional exotic states hiding in the Higgs interactions, but it also gives you some mixing perhaps in the scalar spectrum. And all of these things are phenomenological kind of hallmarks of how you can get sensitivity at the experiments. And they are, of course, very, very important to future collider projections as well, beyond the Hagen-Mossack galaxy. So CP violation, I don't want to talk about, because I actually don't need an awful lot of CP violation to tick that off. But there are certain attempts now on the market to do this even better in the second than before. So the absence of new physics, as we've shown, is ways to do things better. And by looking at concrete theories, so concrete theories meaning that we're doing stuff, we normalize our field theories, where this kind of fox that I've showed you is particularly well-behaved and theoretically robust. We can make very, very robust predictions on the basis of having extra states, having a little bit of Higgs mixing, and all of this kind of feeding into our regions. So how does this work now? You look at the Higgs potential at large enough temperature, it's symmetric, so you essentially have that wine-shaped potential. And if you crank up the temperature, essentially that little the bottom gets smoothed out and you're back with that symmetric potential. So the minimum that we have is a field value is equal to zero. But once you lower the temperature, a second minimum, non-trivial minimum can develop, and then at some point you can tunnel through this little hump, and that's exactly what triggers potentially your first order phase transition. I understand the model, that's not the case, at least not for the masses that you observe. There is much more of a smooth crossover. So it looks like a continuous phase transition rather than something that creates bubbles. It's one of the issues why the standard model cannot explain baryogenesis. And on the previous slide, I showed you a couple of hand-wavy equations to just make this a little bit more concrete. The way how you measure the strength of the phase transition in order to get very strong first order, you want the vacuum expectation value at the critical temperature when the second minimum develops. You want that to be large compared to the temperature at exactly where that phase transition happens. That just sets the boundary conditions right for that spalloping process to do exactly what it wants to do or when it should be. And you can use different measures here, not the critical temperature of percolation, or these bubbles sort of percolate, but none of this matters really for what I want to show you next. And it's not a question, how can we create this? And it's a lesson in statistical physics. So this is really what we teach people in the second year. In order to change the thermodynamics of the system, you really need to change the lowest lying degrees of freedom. You can't, if you have something very, very heavy, it just sits there in the plasma and does nothing. So in order to change really the dynamics in that plasma, you need to change the low lying mass degrees of freedom. There's some caveats that the people, including myself, have been looking into non-perturbative effects that can change as well dramatically. People have been looking at this in quark gluon plasma calculations as well. So this is still a very active area of research. But if we buy into that picture, what does the LHC so far tell us? And well, it tells us that whatever kind of Higgs boson, 125 GeV boson we've observed, it's strongly aligned with the standard model expectation. But if we want something strong first order phase transition that the standard model just can't deliver, these new states need to be light, or we need to modify in a way the lowest lying states that we observe, that is, or the Higgs boson itself. So the first question we can ask ourselves is, where are these exotic states? For instance, let's assume a two-Higgs doublet model kind of ticks all the boxes. We can run these codes. Plenty of codes out there, for instance, possible transitions or BSMPT. So you can download these things, play with it. Not ChatGPT does all the tricks for you. Really, it's that good now. So where are these states? Two-Higgs doublet model. Well, there is a funny interference effect, which is purely accidental in the standard model, between exotic neutral Higgs bosons and QCD background configurations. What I mean is that, so when we look for new particles at the LHC, for instance, with Atlas, you would look for, say, CP odd scalar with 500 GeV that gives you this nice bright Wigner peak. This is what we expect. It's exactly what you get when you calculate a five-minute diagram like that. Top loop, you get the Higgs, and then it decays into tops again. So typically, these extra states, especially in the 2x sampled model, they will be gauge phobic and thermophilic, because by rotating the cold stones into a direction where they get absorbed by the W osmosis, is kind of the language we use for spontaneous invertebration. Whatever is left is orthogonal combinations. They will no longer couple to the gauge body, but they will couple to the firmament. So top philic in physics is typically what we expect in these scenarios. So this is a very well motivated search. But making a distinction between signal topologies and background topologies is something that we're actually not allowed to do in quantum field theory. And typically you get away with it, but in this instance you don't, because you have this background contribution, just as a leading order diagram, knows nothing about spontaneous invertebration. This is old school QCD, very straightforward. But if you do the color decomposition of these interactions, you also see that the TT bar system can be in a color symbol configuration, which this is also the case here. The Higgs has four color charge, it will decay into TT bar, they're fully color correlated. So they can interfere, and they will interfere, and they typically interfere very destructively. So that entire lovely peak that we expect kind of gets sculpted into whatever you like. So you can get dips, you can get flat out distributions. And that, of course, heavily decreases the sensitivity to such searches. Of course, both Atlas and CMS are well aware of these facts, and they're included. It's very difficult to include them in non-specific model ways, but people are working on this. But the take-home story is that if that interference is large, systematics can be bigger than you naively expect from normal bump hunts, and you might as well, in the current phase of the LHC, miss these states. So if we take that 2x sampled model, type 1, for what it's worth, you enter current signal coupling fix, flavor constraints, and you look for exactly these interference effects, what you find is that. So you typically find a large negative interference. What's noted here is the leading order cross-section of the signal plus the interference part, divided by the leading order expectation. So that's kind of a way of, no, sorry. That tells you how much this is a kind of a dimensionless number, how much this nice resonance peak gets deformed into something that we don't like. So if that's large and negative, we are in trouble, or direct searches are in trouble. So it seems like that there is quite a bit of parameter space in these old school models that is difficult to exclude at the current stage. So there's a fair chance that we might miss this. So what I'm trying to do now is kind of create a little bit of a negative story in a way, sort of a nightmare scenario. But there will be a good outcome. So it's my personal version of the telenovela in high energy physics. So bear with me. Now we can ask, we are missing these direct signals at the LHC. Can we see something in correlated Higgs coupling modifications? Because we have misaligned the Higgs boson from standard model expectation ever so slightly, but of course data will come in and we'll measure these couplings more and more precisely as time passes. And the answer is unfortunately not. So what we see here in these lines, the 68-95% confidence level Higgs coupling modification projections written in the parameter of the 2HDM, they don't matter. And these points here, they are successful points where the phase transition is strong. So what's written here is exactly this parameter that tells us how strong the first order phase transition is. We want that to be large, so it should be yellowish. And hopefully they should be outside these constraints. And if they're outside these constraints, we would see some sensitivity at the LHC. And the plethora of these points actually sits within these constraints. So even the large data set of the high luminosity LHC might miss these coupling modifications. All the while, new physics sits right there, hiding right in front of our eyes. Following up from that, current sort of roadmap towards future colliders would entail a position E plus E minus machine that starts off with a position set pole measurement. So essentially it's slip one and steroids, much more data, much more precise. And essentially what you want to do, or what you can do, and people have done this at LED 1, some extent at LED 2 as well, you measure these vacuum polarizations of massive gauge bosons. So X and Y can be the Zs and the Ws, when you include muon decay, for instance, you can really measure that in the W sector as well. And then you can ask, how does this kind of modify, these kinds of topologies, how do they modify physics measurements away from the standard model expectation? And that can be galvanized into two different quantities, it's the S and T parameters, the famous test conductivity parameters, oblique corrections. Doesn't matter what they are, but typically you get these ellipses. And you can see that a lot of these points also sit in the ellipse of the Terra Z program. So you crank up set pole measurements, you measure that very, very precisely. Yet still, a lot of these two HDM points sit within that ellipse. And the Z pole program will not tell you that new physics is there. So we come from the LXC, don't see any exotics. We don't see anything in the position ellipse program at the LXC. And we don't see anything at the Z pole. So that's all terrible news. But new physics is still there. One of the requirements here was that we go away from the standard model first order, well, the zero order, second order phase transition, continuous crossover. So how can that hide in front of our eyes? And the answer is it can't, because I have assumed that new physics is there, and some way or another it will show up, and it will show up at the dedicated fixed front that this FCCEE proposal envision. So that runs at around 240 GeV plus or minus, which is round about where the maximum of the associated fixed production cross section sits. And that probes a lot more stuff than just how the Z boson travels through space and time. In particular, it measures all of these sorts of things, how the Z boson couples to the Z emitters. And that receives corrections also from all the extended fixed sockets that sit there. And this is exactly what triggers the first order phase transition in that particular scenario. And that will drive the cross section away from the standard model expectation. So what's shown here is yellow, green. Greenish is the sensitivity expectation of that associated production cross section at 240 GeV, around about 0.3% for HZ collisions. So that's this horizontal line. And all these kinds of points here that are grayed out, those are the ones that are not, those are just generic scans. And the solid ones are those that are consistent with the STU program of the previous slide. Okay, so those points tell you that we don't see anything up until and including the set pole program at FCCEE. But here now we see that when you include the radiative corrections that sort of happen in these topologies, then the cross-section expectation over the standard model is actually in, going above that sensitivity expectation. So the velocity on the y-axis is the cross-section divided by the standard model expectation. And you can see that all these points are popping out. So by measuring the associated fixed production at FCCEE and measuring that very, very precisely, you would actually see the indirect effects of these new states that secretly in the early universe create more baryons, antibaryons. So the message really is, whatever new physics is there and is talking to the TV scale, this will not hide at FCCEE. So that's quite, I think, a strong outcome and a main motivation for pushing forward with this all the time. Deviations in the precision program at the LHC can still show up. Okay, so it doesn't mean that it's all doom and gloom until 20, 30, 40, 60, or whatever these machines might come online, if they come online at all. So all the while, we might actually see something new. And so there's no reason. So I deliberately painted a relatively pessimistic picture, yet with a positive outcome. But let's focus on something that is perhaps a little bit more revealing in the near term. And while this is good, one can be a little bit dismissive about decoupling. So it only tells you how to explore the cost of two gauge bosons, and it only does so within a certain level of uncertainty. And so perhaps that uncertainty is still too large. I mean, look at that, that's order two. Okay, granted, it's 21, but 5 years is not much in NRC land, so they might have gone down by a little bit. But still, kind of percent level couplings might still be possible. And if that's the case, then actually we're back in business and back in business big time. Because when I showed you that initial picture where you have spontaneous symmetry broken, the Higgs mechanism, the Higgs boson, the physical 125 GeV Higgs boson does a very, very dedicated job. It keeps scattering amplitudes within reason, which means that their growth to high energies is not enhanced, and it can't be enhanced because human therapy tells us that we can't get more out than we put in. And the Higgs boson plays exactly this role, and it's one of the reasons why the LHC really was a phenomenological no-loose experiment, because you had to discover the Higgs boson, or you would see something completely different about technicolor. But the whole idea that nature needs to be unitary really talks, really constrains the Higgs couplings quite precisely. And then you can change things in terms of mixing, and we'll talk about this in a second. But if we see a significant deviation, whatever small from, say, the Higgs coupling to two W's, that old problem reappears. And you again have a no-loose theorem that tells you where to look next. And then, of course, that can feature as well in future collider experiments. But it can also kind of tell you perhaps you're missing a resonance in multi-boson finite states, which are difficult to discern experimentally. So the distributions and sometimes these bits might actually absorb some of these new physics contributions. So any coupling modification that includes the fermion sector as well, that just tells you that unitarity violation is back on the scene, and that tells you directly an energy scale where you should find something. And this is exactly what the standard model pre-Higgs discovery was all about. And then you can ask on the basis of interactions that probe these facets of the Higgs boson sector in the best possible way. The boson fusion really is the way of going about, which WBF collider concept prepares us the best then if we see an outcome at the high luminosity LHC that really reveals the percent level deviation of the Higgs coupling to gauge bosons. So one way of looking at this is a relatively old way of looking at it. It starts with Weinberg in some books in the 60s. So you can calculate these diagrams and the longitudinal polarizations of the W's. They scale at very large energies, like the energy themselves. So naively, this Feynman diagram at amplitude level grows with the fourth power of the center of mass energy. And of course, at some level, you'll start to violate unitarity that way. You have also these diagrams. They come in, they're related to these interactions through gauge symmetry. They give you a relation between these couplings when we write them down as kind of more abstract quantities. They give you some rule like that that tells you that if you have this relation between the quartic interactions and these trilinear interactions that looks like this at the level of these spot-sided couplings, then there is no growth in energy limit to the power of 4. Now that coupling relation seems rather opaque. We have only one Z boson. It's directly a consequence of gauge symmetry. So this is how this picture of gauge symmetry and spontaneous symmetry breaking kind of feeds together and creates a theory that is well behaved in the DPOB. It's exactly what quantum field theory requires you to do. Now, what is the role of the Higgs? Now you have kind of removed the e to the power of fourth growth. You still have e to the power of two growth, and this is really what's dampened by the Higgs boson itself. You have the second subgroup that looks like that, which includes some masses. And those really are relations that are protected by gauge symmetry and spontaneous symmetry breaking. So now you can ask the question, if we see a deviation in the Higgs sector, maybe with more than a single boson, maybe with more than a single Z boson, for instance, in technicolor theory, you can feed that back into the sum rules. And from that, you can then guess the mass scale at which these new particles should show up in order for these sum rules to be fulfilled. So it gives you a recipe to describe the phenomenology only determined by unitarity, gauge symmetry, and convergence of these sum-rules, which is a model independent but not EFT approach to looking for new physics. The two major weak boson fusion machines that are on the market are, of course, FCC-HH and a muon collider. Very different concepts, very busy plot, very far into the future. But the upshot is actually both collider concepts within the limits of how we can kind of understand them now, they give you a similar sensitivity. So it's not a question of which do you prefer or where do you put your X in, which basket do you put your X in. It really both will perform from that perspective at equal levels. So if we see a deviation in the Higgs gauge boson sector, that kind of levels the playing field for at least along the theoretical axis. And then you can focus on what is the better concept to develop accelerator-wise, but also politically. And I have expertise in neither, so I'm not going to attempt that. So that's really a very busy plot, but you that's the take-home story. The lines for discovery are pretty much the same everywhere. It will take a few hundred GeV, so there's not really much in it. The last thing I want to focus on is the third point that I brought up initially. So at least I noted that the sum rule is extremely restrictive, and we saw aspects of this appearing in the sum rules, but also before that. So perhaps the correlations that we are expecting by exciting everything around sum rule sensitivity are too restrictive to find new physics. So it might be hiding in a place we are simply not bothering to look at because we're not expecting it to be relevant. So starting again with that single Higgs coupling, of course, that's not the only coupling that we have in the Higgs sector with gauge bosons. There's this guy as well, where you have two Higgs bosons, both two gauge bosons. And you can ask the question, why don't we have three or four or five like that? So we can play that game forever. But it starts to become really non-trivial because this guy is actually forbidden in some way. So you can't write that down. Which when something doesn't happen or something is excluded, then it might actually be a good idea to look for it. That's what we do with barrier number violation, right? Standard model tells us has to be exactly zero. So looking for it is a worthwhile exercise to shoot a hole in it. Here it's much, much more complicated, okay? But to some degree, people in Atlas and CMS, those amongst you who are working on this, are already doing this. And I think it's probably fair to say it kind of started as an accident, but I assure you it's a lucky accident because it carries a lot of information. So what people like to do is they template these finding diagrams in terms of the coupling. And that's always difficult because by changing one topology, you're changing a lot. And typically then theorists shout gauge invariants and stuff and everybody gets worried. So let's not do that. But there are tools or approaches on the market where this actually does make sense. And then you can ask the question, what is the driving force behind this? So long story short, Atlas and CMS are already modifying these problems independently from those, and independently from those, of course, they appear left, right, and center. In the standard model, these couplings, they are not, they're not independent. Essentially, you get the single Higgs vertex by taking the quartic one and setting the Higgs line, one of the Higgs lines, to the vacuum expectation value. So if you start burying them independently, then you make a mistake and the theory will not be happy. A different way of saying is you can't change one term in the covariant derivative independent from the other. It's just not because they arise from one single term. That being said, QCD doesn't bother about any of this. So you can look into the related corrections to these kinds of topologies from the perspective of quantum chromodynamics. And you can see, it's with a student online in Glasgow before I left, you can see that the next leading order scale uncertain is really, really small. So this is a very, very clean process in discerning multi-Higgs boson interactions in weak boson fusion, albeit the weak boson fusion cross-section sits somewhere in between the most dominant multi-Higgs production. So the fusion is larger and Tc bar hh is a little smaller. So the limits are like that. So we see kappa 2b is very, very sensitive. So scaling this away from the standard model expectation value really triggers quite a cross-section deviation. Why is that the case? Because it's again a story of unitarity. So you can write down the WH amplitude, look at longitudinal polarizations, and you examine the high energy limit, and you see that this exactly traces these relations, kappa 2b minus kappa b squared. So if I change the Higgs sector now by introducing some Higgs mixing in the simplest possible way, I can misalign a single Higgs coupling a little bit from the standard model expectation with one single angle. So can write this down with a similar extension, for instance. And as an immediate check that we normalize the theory is kind of producing good high energy behavior. So if you have kappa V as cosine alpha in these singlet mixing scenarios, kappa 2V will be cosine squared of alpha, you plug this in, you see high energy behavior is great. It's exactly what we normalize the theory is, will tell you. Now, something that you might have heard in your quantum field theory class, but I've immediately forgotten about, is that these longitudinal gauge bosons at very, very large energies behave like Olson bosons. So that's again the magic of renormalizability. I shouldn't say magic, but it really is a beautiful thing how it works out. They behave like derivatively coupled scalars, and that removes all the problems that you would find in these effective theories. So that amplitude, although it pretends to be an amplitude that couples the gauge boson sector to the Higgs boson, it really is a scattering amplitude that is specific to the Higgs sector itself. So, and that tells you something then about how that space of Higgs bosons kind of interacts. And one thing that we always teach our students, starting from year one, is that physics must not depend on the coordinate choices that you do. That's, of course, if I write down Iverson atom and spherical coordinates or Cartesian coordinates, the physics is still the same. The same is true for the Lagrangian. I can write down a different Lagrangian that I can obtain from my original standard model one through a field redefinition, but still give you the same physics. And a theory that kind of tells us or puts this really up front, this general relativity, where all physics around us is essentially determined by how space is curved. And that's also true to some extent for quantum field theory. So if we understand the scalar fields as coordinates in some more abstract space, these amplitudes and these kappa 2b's and kappa b's, they correspond to sectional curvatures in a manifold, which is not space-time, but it is a manifold of the gauge bosons, of the Goldstone bosons and the Higgs bosons themselves. So that gives us a nice way of looking at this in a slightly more abstract way, but in a much more powerful way. So for instance, for compact groups where I define my electroreceiver breaking manifold as a sort of sphere in five dimensions, arguably very abstract, then I get these relations. And composite Higgs theories are very, very difficult theories. Some of you might come across them. But writing this down in terms of this geometric interpretation is very straightforward. It's just really writing down the metric on the sphere and then translating this in a two-liner, really. Ask ChatGPT to do this. It's amazing. You get these coupling relations. So that's perhaps a little bit highbrow, but it has phenomenological consequences. Namely, if I observe with a single Higgs coupling modification cosine alpha, I can always map it onto this ramp site, which measures some of the aspects of this curvature. So I can always do this. But then the question is, do I have an additional Higgs singlet that mixes with the standard model, or do I deal with a strongly interacting theory? There might be other stuff going around, but in case that doesn't happen, how do I discern or how to discriminate between these two possibilities? And you need double Higgs production for that, because you will not be able to kind of reproduce this formula by identifying cosine alpha with kappa being psi. So if you plug this in, the only parameter choice for which that would work would be alpha equals zero. And that would be the standard model, which is obviously not what we observe. If cosine alpha is not equal to zero. So there is merit in these analyses. And you can kind of spin this very, very far, actually. So by decoupling this quartic interaction from the single Higgs interaction, you can really almost landscape the electric sector and how electric integration comes about. So in this Kappa 2B space, you can set constraints at the high luminosity NOC. We did this, my student did this for a bunch of other colliders, for instance, CLIC, which was still, you know, discussed back in the day. Well, it's different now, of course, but, you know, this is the limit where we expect the high luminosity NOC, and of course, it only gets better if we get something else better. But the closer you zero in onto the standard case where kappa B is equal to 1 and kappa 2B is equal to 1, you can really kind of discern what new physics will be just by that single measurement. So for instance, if you have triplet states, fixed triplets, they live up here, they enhance kappa 2B, they decrease kappa B. A singlet scenario, the cosine alpha business that I talked about, tracks this one single line. Composite X models will sit on a line like that. You have hyperbolic composite X models that kind of extend that line up there. Yeah, so you can deform the sphere into a hyperboloid, is that the word? Yeah. That will give you exactly that correlation. And down here, theories that predict a larger kappa B and a smaller kappa 2 B, and see those are super duper exotic. So that's typically something that mixes a dilatonic state, so something that arises from spontaneously breaking off scale invariants together with a composite mix scenario. It's one example how you can do that. So super duper exotic, yeah. So I leave it to you whether you like it, a universe like that. I certainly don't. That measurement would tell us about this. And the way how you can decouple kappa 2b from kappa b is actually very well theoretically rooted in a different way of writing down theories called Higgs effective theory, which has a lot of interesting technical advantages rather than talk about this. But of course, you can exploit these technical advantages to also get indirect sensitivity at precision crossing lines machines moving forward. At intermediate projects in arguably in a very, very long time. So that's my summary. We have not seen new physics so far, but the LHC, as I showed you, has a lot of room left for sensitivity. And there are clear VSM opportunities at the high luminosity LHC and beyond. It would have been nice to discover something new, but we didn't have that serendipitous moment so far. But I think analysis approaches and understanding how data kind of informs theory and how theory can evolve at the level of how we are informed by the data from all experiments, really, not just the LHC, that has kind of left us in a really, really robust shape for whatever comes next. And there are lots of modeling development techniques on the market that are being developed on the new story. Machine learning is really changing the game rather significantly, and I think very much for the better at the moment. Speaking from a phenomenological perspective, I think that we have really too little insights into the electronic scale sector and flavor physics so far. Electronic scale is probably more relevant for the LHC moving forward. But we could still be in for a surprise, and whatever kind of new aspect that we might see, or we might not see anything along these lines at all in terms of this understanding one discovery, that will tell us about its relation of the relation of the TV scale in the broader context of the evolution of the universe very early on in these days. And there are dedicated links that we can exploit or draw between the electron sector and cosmology. So the kind of sometimes I'm a victim of that as well. You think about particle physics really just very narrowly about what interests you. For me, that's Higgs physics and the electric scale. But whatever we learn about that will also inform cosmology, for instance, the SKO program. So there are links that can be exploited moving forward. And I'll leave it with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very well on time. Yes, so let's go to questions. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Really a comprehensive talk. Just on your last point, on the connection between electroweak scale and the cosmology, and how from we do particle physics, how it can solve some of the issues of the cosmology. Could you elaborate a bit more in terms of the vice versa, for example, all the tensions which are going on in the cosmology, how that, those, if you come across anything wherein we can relate to and explore and connect with the electroweak?
Well, people get very excited about how the tension can work. Like, that is something that perhaps that's it's firmly, I think, within the context of cosmology. There are too many things that are not well understood there in order for us to say this is art of physics. But the fact that we see, we have convincing evidence that the phase transition in the standard model is a continuous crossover, that doesn't exclude the possibility of pyrogenesis happening as part of the electroweak phase transition. There are ways how you can do this. The way you need CP violation, but CP violation can string theory gives you what you like. Okay, so CP violation can be induced in certain string theory models at a very, very large scale. So, and then you can hide that in inflation, not directly baryon number generation, but you can source helical magnetic fields as part of the inflationary history that get then transferred in a very shrewd way into a baryon number as part of a second for continuous crossover in the standard model. So pinning down the properties of this animal, finding, really getting to the most precise level in informing these theoretical parameters to tell us that indeed we are now firm believers of a continuous crossover, that tells us that baryogenesis needs to be part of a different cosmological picture. So a null result in my domain of interest is still a result, and it's still a result that carries a lot of weight for people working in other disciplines. So that's just one example of how you can make this work. And that, of course, SKO I mentioned, and they will be able possibly to look more carefully or set additional constraints on these particular scenarios where you create pyrogenesis as part of inflation, or the early seed of pyrogenesis is actually sown as part of inflation through helical magnetic fields. So it's a little bit related to magnetogenesis, if that kind of brings it up. Good question.
I missed a lot of it, and I'm sorry. That means that I can't dispute some details on it. But when you do all this, you include the fact that the universe, you expect some explanation for matter versus antimatter. This is one of these sort of slightly crazy questions that you get. What if the answer is just that you don't need to build in a mechanism for that, and it just was that way?
So
if you release that constraint, how does that change your picture?
It changes it a lot. Of course, it could be an accident, absolutely. It would be a fine-tuned accident.
I mean, maybe not why that might have happened, because who knows, right? But what consequence would that have if you release that constraint in terms of the ways that you look then at what? How constrained you are in terms of thinking about what new physics looks like.
No, I mean, the correlations I showed are very specific to that one simple model that I studied.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fair, I'm not sure you meant it as a criticism, but I could phrase it as a criticism and it would be fair. But still, if you work in renormalized scenarios, it gives you a position really matters, and it becomes very important because it informs a very small set of parameters rather than 2,499. But of course, if you buy into the fact that you have inflation, you have the universe is probably different aspects and different disconnected patches, and you're essentially just an accident. So anthropics, essentially, I think that's kind of it. Is a possibility, but it's not a scientifically useful one, because you could ask that about other things. I mean, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bike, kind of that way. I mean, I think that we have more scenarios where we can explain it with observable facts than just accepting it. So I think our duty is to look for that rather than believe the string theory and just, you know, do other things that, you know, perhaps our politicians think that it's more useful use of our time. So I would disagree with that. Well, yeah, but I think that there's still stuff to be understood out there rather than just your coincidence.
Yeah, so you don't need to appeal to the sort of, so it would simplify the problem, but you don't need to appeal to that holistic plan that answers these various constraints.
I mean, there are these calculations, and the baryon, net baryon symmetry is super small. Mm-hmm. It's tiny. When you start from a symmetric phase, there's essentially no way how you could create this other than, you know, some dramatic cancellation in ways that we don't understand and we have not really seen anywhere else. And there are too many things that we don't understand how gravity talks for all of this. So this is a good question. So how can we marry this together with gravity? You know, this is not part of this. Marrying this together with inflation, try to understand it from the perspective of modified gravities. There's a whole field that we have no idea how that works within the context of the tools that we have developed over the past 50 years. So I think making progress on that, you'll see some new insights. And you know, the cool thing about working in high energy fields is that tomorrow, some smart grad student that nobody's heard of might have all the answers and puts them on the iPad. Wouldn't be the first time. So it's always a little bit doom and gloom until that moment happens. And perhaps my job, being 45 and not having too many good ideas anymore at the moment, it's kind of to conserve that a little bit for until that moment comes, which I'm sure they will come. But no, it's not really an answer.
I think you've got the argument, you know, brilliantly right, which is like keep going,
yeah,
because new things can emerge at any moment. And yeah, I think you do that brilliantly.
Could you go back to page? I think it was eight.
Eight.
Your explicit example of the interference making the nice
turn. That one.
Yeah, that one. This is an Atlas simulation plot. So what I was going to say was that people do attempt to include interference effects. So are there specific things that you think we have missed by not including interference effects, or
no,
we're already?
No, I think that is really the one that is the most dramatic. And it's something physics 84 is quite a while ago. In his final states, this is absent. Even if you go to TT bar H, for instance, absent there as well. So that it's kind of a funny feature because it is model dependent. So you have to run this through the entire analysis chain. There are ways to kind of, so what we've been, one of the first things that I did after arriving in Manchester, set together with a bunch of Atlas people, and we tried to kind of, there's lots of proposals on the market doing bump hunting. You fit the background when the bump exists, it's not too difficult. If you do this with dips, it's slightly more delicate because you need some aspects of models that kind of model that, but maybe in a fairly robust way, not too model dependently. And to some extent, you can do that. And we did write a paper. I should have mentioned it here, but it's the title is Big Dipper Showing Me the Way. So put a rip off on the Wolfpack song. I didn't come up with that answer. Help me find a way.
Okay, in terms of a bump hunt, I want you to find it because you also always have a bump, not only dip, it's a dip, right?
Yeah, this is where my limited understanding of statistics comes in. But in the good old days of CDF physics, when the CLS method was still in play, you did it through ratios of confidence levels. So essentially, you would not really gain sensitivity there because the consistency with the background on the hypothesis would be low already. So perhaps with more asymptotically safe likelihoods that people are using now, this is a lot better. But the what we had a look at there, I mean, I didn't question, maybe should have put it in, but too late now. But the question that we really set out to ask is, if you see a dip, question is, what is the likelihood that it arises from a bump like that, rather than just, because a dip structure that's just statistical fluctuation will look differently typically. And the model-dependent link between these CPE and CPO is actually not that strong when you think about it as a diagnostic of new physics, rather than reproducing the parameters of the function, or measuring the couplings of these new exotic states. That's always model-dependent, also in a bump hunt. But as a diagnostic, I think it does work.
Just about the CMS, but this is a much more simple thing, which is the Z prime, which obviously doesn't matter. It's not quite as dramatic as this, but we try and take this into account. And there's some more efforts trying to model with on with the end of test.
Yeah, that's just a funny thing. Probably people have already solved this, and because it's behind the paywall, I'm not aware of that. But then it gives me another line of inspire. You know?
I mean, I think maybe the point is what you were saying earlier. It's for each specific model.
Mm.
You can do some parameterization which sort of takes into account. But if you want to be very generic, it's hard to write something down that cleanly factorizes all the terms that you can stick into your.
I mean, there are quasi given it, that depends on the order of perturbation theory you work in. But this you could even write down as a quasi analytical expression. So there are ways of doing that. But with a bump hunt as well, if you see some excess, it can have different meanings in different models, but the excess is there and can kind of literally turn this around and do the same for a dip structure as well.
Yeah. I think this is a more generic problem as well. If you look back to sort of run to ideas such as where they're reparameterized in terms of object dimensions and Reynolds and graviton models. I failed to convince Atlas that taking a point mass with detector resolution was the wrong thing, because then they neglect the natural limits of the Higgs resolution just depending. So there'll be a whole swathe of intercept searches where the paper's just wrong and the limits are too optimistic because you're not taking into the fact that your TV Higgs has a TV with unified TV. Is got a mark whip as well. Hopefully now they've finally caught on the fact that's really done physics, and they should have done some basic physics. I'm saying that as a someone who was working on that paper and just failed to convince Venus to listen. But it's not just these effects that are problematic and need to be done carefully. A little bit like the Penderbilt searches as well. I remember. Discussions on how to try and think about the ICP and the quark. You need to look at the interface, the inference. You need to look at the phase diagram, the phase is a function of resonance. Once you've got something, you can do the analysis and you can really reverse engineer the parameters of the model. But
the beach is a bump. Absolutely. The bump is you don't need a model for a bump. But to get the inference right,
it turns out that you also get away with almost murder by assuming a simple model that does most of the job in order to look statistically reliable, at least for the scenarios that we looked at. And that was kind of surprising to me, but it's a positive story, right? Because if you were to see this, you could actually quickly convince yourself that your physics is there. But I appreciate if you do this in 2HDM type 3 with these parameters, because some germs have been shouting at you because they're using the wrong model that they don't like. Then, of course, you need to get these aspects right. There's a lot of calculus involved there as well. But to discover new physics, it's always harder to set limits and discover stuff when it's not. Unless it's systematic. So, I'm a theorist, I don't care about this.
Actually, just to follow up on that, I had the same problem with Atlas and Run 1, where the Z prime analysis, we're putting over, they were refusing to believe us, refusing to believe the paper, there's somebody out very optimistic that there's nothing intercepted for interference.
Took me 18 months, but
I wasn't going to bring
it. I know, but I think as you just mentioned that, it's one of the things that really
important. As an Atlas collaborator, it took 18 months to get them to pull the incorrect case on the new collaborative result.
It's very important.
Yes.
Can I see another question?
Yeah, sure. No, no, no.
And again, I didn't see this total flow of slides, but to my taste, what I think is the most helpful is to have results that stand the test of time. And that means assuming as little as possible and doing as little as possible of this work. So there's a sort of, collaborations wish, of course, to make discoveries, and you can only make discoveries if you're comparing accurately to a model. On the other hand, does that make for the most long-lasting statements about, what fundamentally happened when some particles interacted? What's your taste on that? Because we're going to go into a whole phase now of sort of legacy making,
right? I think that kind of highlights it in a way, because you can assume specific models, and these specific models will have different decoupling limits. But what really matters when you look at the GEV scale is the alignment of 125 GEV boson to standard model expectation. That's one handle. And then extra stuff that goes on in the Higgs potential, which is a motivated sector. End of story. These two things, they will talk to each other in specific models in specific ways. But the phenomenological handle is relatively similar. So this is why we chose the 2HDM, because it covers these bases in a relatively minimalist way. You get Higgs mixing, so you get misalignment. You get modifications of the Higgs trilinear coupling, and you get interactions of the Higgs boson within the exotic spectrum that might be getting. And all of these things kind of galvanize into cross-section modifications. So if you want these effects to do something positive for you, like create more bargains and anti-bargains, or here, this is really not what we did, but create a stronger first order phase transition than the continuous crossover that we see in the standard model. Then these patterns of couplings and Mars hierarchies, they will not directly talk. There's no one-to-one correspondence. If I had this strength of the phase transition correlated with the cross-section modifications, we'll be all over the shop in the scattering plot. But if you have heavy physics, that is, but you are away from the alignment limit still, you will see modifications through radiative corrections in the crossing minus physics. So after these results, I'm kind of hopeful, because I can't prove that, but all the reasonable phenomenological handles that you need to address these situations are reflected here, and the outcome is a positive one. So you can only be sure within the scenario that you're looking at, but then by critically evaluating what goes in before the sausage machine, you can convince yourself that nothing weird is happening in the process. So I think whatever scenario you might be looking at will have similar features and will have similar phenomenological outcomes. What this then means in terms of mapping it onto a parameter 124 in that particular Lagrange, to me that's relevant. What matters is the cross section. If it goes away from the standard model expectation, if we can observe that, then we're in business.
Thank you.
There's
some time pressure.
Okay, one question.
Yeah.
You mentioned also on this plot, what would be the impact if you said we ignore the city violation in the mental set by the trigger. What if we find something better?
Would the CP point, the starting CP point, difficult for us in Colline Phillips?
Right.
And his sector point would be absolutely fantastic. Would it move concretely for this calculation? Would be bad news for the grad student who has to calculate it, because there are quite a lot more moving parts then. I mean, by assuming CP conservation, you do not have a lot of Higgs mixing diagrams which you need to calculate here for. At the moment, the CP odd state is allowed to mix with the CP, even so it becomes technically more challenging. But you really don't need an author of additional CP evaluations. Typically, these effects are very small. So again, if we allow for CP violation to the level where we tick the box of the Sakharov criteria, this I give you my 95% confidence level that this plot will still hold.
Anything online? Questions online?
Yeah, I don't see online. Yes. One last question. You used baryogenesis in the first line as an example. So lay out your strategy, what would be another phenomena that, for example, dark matter or something that,
yeah.
that is unresolved?
Yeah.
That would fit within this frame.
You could do it with leptogens. It works exactly the same way. You would see stuff in the lepton sector then. Let's see what I have in the backup if I can bring it. Yeah. The dark matter, similar in a way, because if you have something that couples to the standard model, like something like this export scenario, there will be new contributions of the Fischer scalar. That, as part of the renormalization program, gives you a uniform coupling rescaling in Higgs bosons interaction with whatever matter. And you measure that precisely, you can set indirect limits on this scalar, even if that only comes to the X in this classic X bosons matter. Then you have to worry about direct detection, which kind of kills this minimal scenario because these data are very, very precise to the level where the minimum scenarios do not really work. But there is work on the way where people are looking into generalizations of these interactions and thereby gain perhaps new phenomenological kind of test cases to be looked into at the NXC, but also different or non collider developments.
Yeah.
You can do that. Yeah.
Okay. I got it. Yes. Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. I have any questions. So we can go to lunch. You're welcome to join. Thank you very much for coming.
Good to see you again.
Good seeing you.
Thank you.